Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of the land on which we find ourselves. I'm Antonia Finane from the School of Historical Studies at this university, and I'm chairing this evening's session of the Festival of Ideas, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here on behalf of the university. The proceedings this evening are being filmed and audio recorded, and I have to ask you all to make sure that your mobile phones are turned off. It's my pleasure and duty otherwise to introduce our distinguished guest and keynote speaker, Professor Wang Gungwu, Professor at National University of Singapore, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University, former Vice Chancellor of Hong Kong University, a much published historian whose books span a millennium of history from the 10th to the 20th centuries and which have won him among many honours, most recently a D.Litt from Cambridge University, which was awarded a couple of days ago. I don't have time to introduce this rich body of work that he has produced this evening, so let me boil it all down to a brief biographical reference that will give you an idea of where it all comes from. Professor Wang was born in Surabaya to parents from China. He was raised in Malaya, as it was then, paid his first visit to China as a small child before World War II. He went back after World War II to enrol in Nanjing University. Had it not been for the civil war between the nationalists and the communists at that time, and the establishment of the People's Republic in 1949, he may never have returned to the university, to university in Malaya, or undertaken his PhD at the University of London before going on to take university positions in Kuala Lumpur and then Canberra. He did do all these things, and thus embodies the history which has been his life's work, a history largely engaged with China and the Chinese in Southeast Asia from a Southeast Asian perspective and sometimes from an Australian perspective as well. He's uniquely well placed to speak on the topic of China and the West, having spent much of his life poised between the two and looking from one to the other. Before taking up his position at Hong Kong University, Professor Wang spent nearly 20 years at the Australian National University as Professor of Far Eastern History and Director of the Research School of Pacific Studies. It was this period, I guess, that established his foundations, his roots in Australia, roots to which he keeps returning like those falling leaves of the saying. I was one of the many students whom he patiently guided through the difficult terrain of a PhD in Chinese history. So it's a special privilege for me to chair this session tonight. The keynote speech of this evening sets the tone for tomorrow's proceedings, in which we turn decisively from west to east with sessions on China and Australia, China and the New Economic Order, and the rise of contemporary Chinese art, to all of which you're all welcome. This evening there will be a short time for questions and discussion from the floor after Professor Wang has finished his address. Thanks, Professor Wang.
Thank you, Antonia. It is indeed a great pleasure to be here this evening, not only to be in this very fine Maya Center and to restore my links with Asia Link, but also to have Antonia chair this session. As she mentioned, we've known each other for quite a while, and it has been a tremendous pleasure to have had Antonia with us at ANU and to see her do so well in all her work, and her most recent books have been particularly appreciated by all of us. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am very privileged to speak at this Festival of Ideas. I'm delighted to be back. this lovely city. If my wife had been with me tonight, I know she would agree with me when I say that this city is our second home. In any case, what a pleasure to be part of the Festival of Ideas. There are many ways to talk about China and the West. To compare the two would provoke those who believe that such attempts are bound to fail because no one can know what the real China or the real West is. To concentrate on the relations between China and the West would be much easier, and one could talk about the course of diplomatic ties between China and certain major Western countries, or about the growth of their trading and financial relations. But this is a festival of ideas, so we could turn to the ideas and portray the West as representing one set of ideas and China as standing for another. Depending on whether we choose to emphasize the unique and particular or what purports to be universal, the two could look very different or could be made to appear somewhat similar. On the other hand, if we concentrate on the ideas that people have about China and about the West, then we would be looking at sets of changing perceptions. It is possible to survey what the dominant ideas the Chinese have had and now still have of the West, and similarly, what Westerners have had and now have of China, however incoherent these ideas might have been and still remain today. The festival organizers have added the words, the puzzling past and the uneasy present. Now that moves the focus somewhat. It moves it to people, the people who are puzzled and uneasy today, and encourages us to look at the perspectives that people have of each other. Clearly, many are puzzled. For example, many Chinese must be puzzled why the great Australian mining company Rio Tinto was keen to let the Chinese from Chinalco buy into it and then became fearful and changed its mind. Being puzzled is not necessarily a bad thing. I would be uneasy if Chinese and Western leaders are never puzzled about each other, or what each other thought or did. To be absolutely certain that you know can sometimes be delusive. When one set of political leaders concludes that the enemy is the equivalent of Satan on earth, and in retaliation the other accuses the first of forming an axis of evil, that kind of clarity could be frightening. Against that, one might prefer to be only puzzled, but be very alert and wary. Earlier this month, in President Obama's lecture to the Cairo University students, he made great efforts to reduce puzzlement among all concerned. At the end of his speech, everyone appreciated the clarity behind each word he uttered. Yet it is obvious that that unease has not been diminished after his speech. The Christian West and the Muslim communities across the Mediterranean have been in direct and intense contact for over 14 centuries. If it is so difficult to dispel puzzlement and eliminate unease after so long, it is hardly surprising that the West and China, which had been acutely aware of each other for only 200 years, should look quizzically at each other. If President Obama managed to turn ignorance into mere puzzlement and fear into simple unease, that may be the best way forward. Where China and the West are concerned, there is much to be puzzled about. Thousands of books and articles have now been written, some dispelling puzzlement, but many actually adding to it. It is not possible to do justice to the work of these pioneers. I shall simply select a some examples, a few examples from more recent times. But before I do that, let me outline the main trajectories of thinking prior to the 20th century. The picture is a very mixed one. The ancient Chinese had wondrous and sometimes idyllic images of the West, as they saw it, the West, often referring to regions from where great wisdom came. But the ideas were never about one place or one set of artifacts. Nor was there sustained curiosity about what that West really stood for. It was enough to know that these people were far away, that they lived in different kinds of cities, and that some of them made a living from long-distance trade in precious goods. Many of these Westerners were known to believe in strange gods. Interestingly, the Chinese took into their hearts Buddhism from India, from the West. For them, these Buddhists came to symbolize the civilized West for nearly 1,000 years. In comparison, ideas that came from other parts of the West seemed inferior and uninspiring to them. For the most part, the West was conceived of as a vague and distant region that reached the far ends of the Eurasian continent, and nothing there could compare with the civilization developed in China. What ideas and institutions they had were of limited value to the Chinese, who believed that by accepting Buddhism from the West, from what they see as the West, they had taken enough from outside to enable their own Confucianism to achieve high levels of thought and practice. Once they were sure of that, the need to understand what was alien became unnecessary. What peoples in the West thought about China seemed to have been no less vague. They had contacts with the Chinese Empire, but only a few people from the great civilizations of the Greco-Romans, now identified with the West, or the Persians, or the Indians, or the Muslim Arabs. Only a few are known to have crossed the deserts and mountain ranges overland, or sailed south and eastwards across the Indian Ocean and the China Seas. Their images of China were of an entity that was distant, if not isolated, and not a little puzzling. But at least for some 3 millennia, there was no fear of China whatsoever. That empire was known to have been mighty, but its presence was virtually non-existent to most people. The Chinese recorded their earlier awareness of Europeans when the Falangi, or Franks, mostly Portuguese, mainly Portuguese and Spanish, arrived on the China coast during the 16th century. These Franks were seen, at least in part, through the prism of the Muslims, who had long been trading with the Chinese and identified these newcomers as aggressive. That image remained, even when new names were found for the later Dutch and English arrivals, whom the Chinese called red-haired Fan, equivalent to red-haired Indians. Later, other names were used, all reflecting a mixture of puzzlement, contempt, and unease that changed in the 20th century to strong mixtures of bafflement, admiration, and fear. The Europeans acquired a more dramatic picture of China thanks to the book of Marco Polo and sundry other imaginary writings. That image turned on the stories of powerful rulers and wealthy communities on the far side of a remote world. Together with similar images of India, they inspired generations of Europeans to seek to find their way there. As targets of profitable trade, India and China signified the bypassing of the troublesome Moors, the Muslims, that several Christian crusades had failed to displace from their monopolistic positions astride the Eurasian continent. There is still something familiar about the West today, seeking allies in East and Southeast Asia to deal with the heartlands of terrorism. Then came Matteo Ricci and his band of Jesuits, who for the next 200 years represented the civilized West to the rulers and mandarins of China. It was a remarkable encounter that promised to enlighten two worlds. On the one hand, the scientific and philosophical fruits of Renaissance Europe, seen largely through the eyes of enlightened Catholic minds, Catholic monks, were introduced to a few imaginative Chinese literati, only a few. On the other, the Jesuits reported home about a large centralized state with a powerful system of government supported by a distinctive civilization, one that managed to survive the murderous conquest by Manchurian tribes. Now, these glowing Jesuit reports surprised the educated classes of Western Europe and fed new ideas to the leading thinkers of the Enlightenment. The hard-headed European merchants, however, those who traded all over Asia and along the China coast at that time, were much less impressed. They found that behind their elegant robes, Ming and Qing officials were no less greedy and inefficient than officials elsewhere. Where shipping and weaponry was concerned, they found the Chinese backward. And finally, the powerful British broke through Chinese coastal defenses by the middle of the 19th century. The Christian missionaries who followed them to work among native sailors and peasants were convinced that the vast majority of the people were benighted and superstitious, and that they should save these people from their stubborn local beliefs. It really did not take long for the idea of China as a great civilization to fall from grace. By the end of the 19th century, the picture was one of a country with a decaying set of institutions that needed only a small push to collapse on its own weight. The only surprise, most of all to the Chinese themselves, was that it was the small nation of Japan that did the last bit of pushing. Within two decades, China was near chaos. What was worse, it had to seek help from the Western powers to save it from dismemberment, most particularly from the ambitions of its neighbors, Japan and Tsarist Russia, then a later Soviet Russia as well. China, as a puzzle, really began at the end of the 19th century. Among the questions asked among Chinese and Westerners alike was, how could such a strong state, with its powerful cultural heritage, be undone so quickly? Why did a small number of young scholars and intellectuals in China after 1911 come to reject their past so quickly and so thoroughly? Many suggestions were made, but there was little hurry to arrive at answers because the puzzle evoked more pity than unease. For the Chinese, the West was also puzzling from the beginning of their encounters. The Mandarins who dealt with the armed Iberian fleets of the 16th century found the people rough and aggressive. Some respected the scholarly and peaceful Jesuits, as I mentioned earlier, but thought that the religious practices of their fellow Europeans were superstitious. They did admire the maps and mathematics, all the calculations that were introduced by the Jesuits, and they also learned to copy the guns and cannons, first from the Portuguese, then the Dutch and the British. But the idea that the West stood for a civilizational challenge to China did not occur to the Chinese literati until it was too late. To the Chinese, the greatest puzzle was how small European warring states, could develop the economic and naval power to travel such great distances and yet overwhelm the great Qing Empire. After the defeat in 1895 by the Japanese military, who had copied the West so successfully and speeded up the collapse of China's imperial system, China's best and brightest identified two sets of ideas as vital to the task of saving China. Both came from the West. One gave priority to revolution and industrialization as a new road to political power. The other linked the road to modernity and progress with freedom and democracy. By that time, all Chinese leaders had agreed that science was at the heart of Western success. But they could not agree about how a strong, united China should come about. In the end, it was the force of events and the speed of their unfolding that determined the direction China was to take. The threat of foreign conquest and the potential dismemberment of the lands the Republic had inherited drove all ideas of freedom and democracy into the shadows. Salvation and unification at all cost became the slogans that had the widest appeal. It was, as had always been, the armies that won on the battlefield that decided the fate of China. And finally, in 1949, after a civil war that had lasted off and on for over 20 years, China could look forward to rebuild its future. And this is what gave legitimacy to the victorious party that flew the communist flag, if not accepting the ideas of European communism. For many centuries, puzzlement among Westerners often grew into bafflement, frustration, and anger. But there had never been any reason for fear. Among Chinese, unease did slowly accumulate through the centuries and eventually hardened into alarm. But after the mid-19th century, there was greater clarity all around. With China on its knees for at least a century after that, all Westerners, now including the Japanese, could see China as a country that was easy to exploit commercially, economically, one that needed help against the more predatory powers, and one to be re-educated, if not re-civilized. For some, the Chinese people were to be pitied, and it was time to save their souls. During this period, the Chinese were equally clear that they had to learn from the West. There was great admiration of Western success, in particular of their military power and economic wealth, but also of their political unity as nation states. Accompanying all that were profound regrets, the failures of Chinese leaders, the stagnation of what had been resilient institutions, and perhaps most painfully, for the literati at least, the inadequacies of what to them were universal Confucian values. However, in seeking to learn from that West, some were attracted to Western self-criticisms and were drawn to alternative agendas like those of the German National Socialists and the Soviet interpretations of Western imperialism and capitalism. And this actually fed the hopes of the younger Chinese who looked for inspirational weapons to rid China of Western dominance. The desire of many Chinese to challenge the prevailing ideas of Western racial superiority also became stronger. It came from their growing resentment at the barely disguised disdain, if not contempt, that they experienced. Paradoxically, the strong emotions aroused came at a time when there was a simple clarity in Chinese ideas about the West, an equal clarity in Western perceptions of China. For the Chinese, whether it was admiration, resentment, or rejection, all had to be channeled into mastering the West's secrets. If there was any unease among the leading thinkers of the time, it came from a nagging doubt whether, after learning all they could, they would not end up by being imitation Westerners with little self-respect for what they would become. For Westerners, it was inconceivable that the Chinese could restore their ancient civilization. So the question was simply, how long would it take for the Chinese to learn Western ways, and how modern could they ever be? Being uncertain about the answers to this question may be the prime reason for the state of unease among them today. In the end, the Chinese discovered that their moments of clarity were illusory. The people had fought for survival under conditions of poverty, regret, and even despair. At the end of the Civil War in 1949, with the victory of the Chinese Communist Party, a new era of questioning and confusion was to follow. There were by that time more kinds of Chinese who had been exposed to different faces of the West. Apart from those who chose the Western ideas of Marx and Lenin, others within China were forced to renounce all that they had learned about modernity during the previous decades. Outside the People's Republic of China, the nationalists in Taiwan tried to raise the flag of American-backed anti-communist freedom and democracy. Elsewhere, tens of millions of overseas Chinese who were living in other people's nation states were forced to make decisions about their loyalties and identities. In reality, for the rest of the 20th century, very few Chinese had genuine choices they could freely make. In 1971, the People's Republic of China was admitted into the United Nations as the only China. On the surface, China's leaders had never been surer of their position in the world. Mao Zedong's certainties, his many certainties during the Cultural Revolution years, certainties about the future of the Chinese Communist Party, about his political enemies within and the country's enemies without, were never stronger. No one in China would allow to disagree with that. But deep down, the people of China had never been more puzzled as to who they were or where the country was heading. For example, was the United States the enemy, or was the Soviet Union the greater enemy? Was Lenin still relevant? Was Confucius not already in the dustbin of history? If so, why was it so urgent to keep on denouncing him again and again? Had Mao Zedong mastered Western Marxist ideas so well that he could lead the Chinese as a kind of modernizing emperor back to Chinese values again? All very confusing. If the Cultural Revolution had confused the people about some dichotomies, the return of Deng Xiaoping replaced one set of bafflements with other uncertainties when he decided to open the country up to the West again. What was this new opening to mean? After the nightmare of the previous decade, that decision was warmly welcomed. The challenge to learn from the world outside was widely taken up, often with enthusiasm. The flood of scholars, students, and officials to the West over the next decades was one of the most remarkable in history. During the first decade of this renewed opening, some ideas and images appeared clear enough. The West had more to teach China than the Soviet Union under Gorbachev. The universities, especially those in the United States, had the most to offer in the fields of science and engineering and technology. The West was complex, variable, and most exciting. For some, no less so were the neighboring East Asian societies that had benefited so much from the capitalist model of economic development. There was then another flood inwards, as Western ideas were introduced to books, to translated books, magazines, and other transmission media, again at an unprecedented speed. Everything was either new or rediscovered, and the impact seemed instant among the young who crammed into the universities of institutions of learning, and particularly the universities that were available at the time. The country could not build institutions fast enough to cope with the Russian demand. And those with access could hardly be blamed for being carried away by the contrast between what they could read about the West for themselves and the negative images that officials and teachers were warning them against. The policy of opening up for these young minds was close to revolutionary in effect. Thus, following the sacking of the CCP's Secretary General, Hu Yaobang, when attempts to slow things down in 1987 to 1989 were accompanied by inflation and corruption in high places, the atmosphere in China became very tense. And when Hu Yaobang died in April 1989, demonstrations of grief led to massive displays of dissatisfaction with ongoing policies. And this led to tragedy at Tiananmen for many students and Beijing residents. But it was also a setback for Deng Xiaoping's bold call to let more people learn from the West. But the time for even greater puzzlement had only just begun. Unexpectedly, the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War ended. The West was seen to revise its expectations of China now that it was triumphant and no longer needed China as an ally against Russia. Among many Chinese, even among those who had gone abroad to study, there began to grow a gap between those who thought the West could meet China's needs, all China's needs, in fact, and those who now saw the West as trying to thwart China's developments. Seeing the danger this could become to his vision of the future, Deng Xiaoping in 1992 took decisive steps to overcome his party's fears of the West. His boldness was remarkably successful, and it enabled an even greater opening of China to the forces of the global market economy. Did this clarify matters for the Chinese people? I don't think so. The United States was now the world's sole superpower. Global financial cycles were poorly understood in Asia, and in the late 1990s, poorly managed policies nearly destroyed the whole region's development plans. China, however, was learning fast about how Western institutions worked, most markedly, how the international system of nation states might be made to serve China's own national interests. The expertise that they gained from the thousands of students and officials who had studied abroad and had mastered the mechanisms that governed the globalizing world had begun to pay off. This made a significant difference to the way China managed its Western partners and competitors thereafter. China's rapid development, economic development during the past decade is a measure of what the Chinese now know about the West. Its confidence in standing up to continuous Western criticisms also demonstrates how well its leaders understand what it can accept and what it does not have to tolerate. It does not help, however, that China's system of governance is notoriously weak in dealing with issues of justice, of injustice and corruption. For all the respect that Premier Wen Jiabao gets for his very caring approach to the needy and the unfortunate, it is clear that he cannot prevent malfeasance from occurring on his watch. And when things go wrong and are reported in the local and foreign media, there are still serious miscalculations and serious failures of communication. This seemed to have become unavoidable even when China seeks the approval of the West. In short, there is now less puzzlement about the West. After all, the West is more transparent, and it would seem only a matter of time when enough knowledge is available and understanding can begin. With increasing clarity, however, there are also fewer illusions. Fuller knowledge is not always reassuring. The Chinese are aware that some unease may be healthy, if not inevitable. Let me give you some examples. The American military is vastly superior in arms and technology to any in the world. And yet the Pentagon constantly claims to fear China's military expenditures. This is something that can really be puzzling. Why has the United States appeared to encourage the fear of China among its neighbors? Why does the West underline the size of China's economy and play down the poverty of its population? It is true that China is full of contradictions, but the Chinese have noted that there are contradictions among countries in the West as well. For example, Chancellor Angela Merkel said a few weeks ago, I quote, "People want more than freedom and democracy. They also aspire to economic security and rightly demand opportunities to achieve prosperity. We need a strong and effective state," unquote. When Chancellor Merkel said that, she was applauded. This was at the anniversary of the Federal Constitution of Germany. But the Chinese know that when their leaders say something like that or anything like that, the Western media would deride them as merely making excuses not to introduce political reforms. The credibility gap between China and the West obviously reflects a lack of trust between governments. When there is such a gap, it is unlikely that the Chinese would agree that it is always they who are to blame. Many Chinese in China know that their government deserves a bad press on certain matters. But they may well conclude from the way the Chinese leaders are talked about in the West that many Western countries will not be happy until they can provoke a regime change in the country. There are other questions one can ask. Are the Chinese more puzzled by the West than Westerners are about China? Who should be uneasier? Does it matter anyway? The example of Mao Zedong is useful here. Most accounts in the West portray him as a tyrant and compare him with Hitler and Stalin. That is, he's actually made out to be rather like a modern European dictator. Many Chinese would quite agree with that image, but more might accept Mao Zedong's image of himself as a leader who can be compared with the great dynastic founders of the past. Yet in Mao Zedong's mind, he rejected the Chinese cyclical view of history. He had opted instead for a most un-Chinese linear progression towards communist salvation. He had also been described in the West as a romantic revolutionary. This is something that most Chinese would have great difficulty in understanding. In addition, Mao Zedong was a great believer in technology and industrialization and proudly insisted that his socialism was truly scientific. Now, in modern parlance, he could be described as someone who believed in creative destruction, a phrase that I learned that is quite approved of in the capitalist world. In short, Mao Zedong is still made to embody the complex image of an educated Chinese in whom the past still stirs the imagination, but for whom the present is even more powerful and demanding. He thus symbolizes the painful efforts of three generations of Chinese who have tried to achieve modernity, while at the same time trawling the past for inspiration, even to the point of cannibalizing it, just to reassure them of authenticity. Chinese today are aware that Mao Zedong destroyed enough so that it is possible to contemplate fresh starts to accept a westernized civilization that might in the future still credibly be recognized as Chinese. All this will be puzzling to the West. But is it any less puzzling to the Chinese themselves? We are reminded of the almost free-for-all experimentations with ideas from the West that the Chinese intellectuals enjoyed during the 1920s and 1930s. That generation did so under conditions of severe economic deprivation and near political anarchy. The difference today is that Chinese leaders want the country to avoid ever being poor and divided again. They are prepared to face defiant efforts by the thinkers and artists in the country to to expose and criticize their methods and question their motive, which many artists and thinkers in China are doing right now. And the leaders know that, but they're prepared to face it because they have something else on their minds. At times, in fact, to the surprise of many, they have even allowed some very rather innovative ways that people have used in China to inject variety and excitement into rather thin and diffuse environment for ideas. The Western tradition prefers ideas to be clear and precise so that problems can be identified and solved, hence the power of logic and scientific progress. Modern Chinese are now similarly inclined, but they recognize that they still live and work in a huge and multifarious society that is accustomed to layers of ambiguity and cannot easily move away from that condition. No one now wants to return to the destructive, single-minded clarity of purpose that Mao Zedong was wont to project. The leaders of the Communist Party want to ensure that this can never happen again. In order to do this, they are willing to employ all measures available, even if it meant keeping people puzzled much longer. Despite what I've said, I think that Westerners are on the whole more puzzled about China than the Chinese are about the West. Should this make the West feel more uneasy? A year ago, I would have said no. But with the financial crises that threaten another period of recession and a restructuring of the global market economy on the cards, the question is now more open. How the West works with the rising economic giants like China and India will determine whether the world will feel safer or less secure after the changes that follow. Before I conclude, let me return to China's puzzling past. For the West, the underlying unpredictability of China's politics, linked with that past, poses real difficulties. We know that experts in and outside China have failed to predict any of the power transitions that the Chinese have experienced over the past 100 years. With each shift of direction, they have had to look to the past, whether immediate or distant past, to try and help them explain and what happened. I repeat, this was only just to explain. There are no claims that the explanations would enable them to predict the next change. All the same, the unease felt about the present should lead us to confront whatever puzzles us about the past. Going back in time does not lead to more accurate predictions, I know that, but it can draw attention to the factors that make a difference, the factors that make a difference when a transition or a turning point is due. I propose that careful note be taken of the following features in the emergence of a modern state in China. Firstly, Late Qing intellectuals were struck by how modern international relations and the constant wars between European states during the past 300 years reminded them of the warring states of their own history in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. However, they had thought that their concept of the Tianxia, the all under heaven concept, the idea of a cosmic moral authority that was widely recognized, could provide great support for enduring peaceful relations among states. Chinese leaders today, of course, see no place for that ancient idea, but they are still drawn, I believe, to the ideal of a universal order that stands for security and peace everywhere. That, I think, may still guide their thinking when the world eventually agrees that the current international system probably needs revising. Secondly, when the Chinese replaced the empire with the republic in 1912, they had no idea what that really meant. citizenship and notions of democracy that accompany the idea of a republic and that strengthen the modern nation state were very far from their minds. The key issue was unification and survival. And that required collective action against those who were out to exploit China's weaknesses and who wanted to carve up that state, the state that the Republican China had inherited. It is significant that till this day, China's leaders desire above all to restore older ideas of stability and harmony and emphasize a word like Minban, which they use today, which is sort of everything for the people, rather than Minzhu, democracy, ruled by people, by the people. The question is how far they will go to defend that position and whether they will ultimately disaggregate the many collective institutions that they now depend on. Thirdly, the idea of revolution at the beginning of the 20th century galvanized generations of youth to sacrifice themselves for a stronger and more prosperous China. After what may be seen as three stages in that revolution, in 1911, in 1949, and then again in 1978, China has reached the threshold of economic power in many eyes. In terms of traditional history, this could be compared to the consolidation era after a new dynasty was founded, when rulers could hope for a longer period of power and tranquility. In 20th century revolutionary history, at least elsewhere that the Chinese have studied, three paths were followed, particularly in Europe. The French route of several transformations to reach its current stability, the German road to dictatorship and destruction, and the Russian reach for world dictatorship, for world leadership. The Chinese had been converted to the idea of linear progress towards an ideal but distant goal under Mao Zedong. If that is now seen as utopian, how will China find its own path to long-term comfort and safety for the country? Will it be confident to receive offers from the West to help them achieve that? Fourthly, Communist Party leaders have continued to refer to Marxism or socialism as the key guide to the future, even when the country seems committed to follow a modified capitalism to prosperity. This is a corrective to the Chinese tendency to turn to the ancient past for wisdom. It represents a reaffirmation that China is on the road to modernity. It suggests that the recent and immediate past, not only of China, but also of other countries and regions, will be given more weight in their eyes. The question is, how would the Chinese people respond if the present government fails and loses authority or credibility and ultimately legitimacy? To what extent would they turn back to the deeper roots of the country's past? Would they continue to accept that China as a nation state must seek to find answers together and in harmony with the rest of the world? The final issue concerns the place of law, science, and religion in China's future. For centuries, all knowledge and faiths were subordinated to the imperial state, and that seems to have remained so since the foundation of the Republic. This has not changed after several stages of revolution. The legal organs of the state were modified, and efforts have recently been made to reform them further. Religious freedom is conditional on degrees of official supervision. Freedom of the media is similarly regulated. In comparison, there has been very strong financial support for advancing scientific knowledge, and I understand inventive breakthroughs are now hoped for. But in the end, there is no departure from the traditional principle of state supremacy, where all these institutions must either serve the state's interest or at least not be used against the state. The underlying respect for and attention to layers of past practices and thought are remarkable. And this leads us to ask, is this simply a matter of preserving the power of the Chinese Communist Party, or possibly the necessary and ultimate comfort zone for most Chinese people? These examples of the puzzling past are what Chinese and non-Chinese alike seek answers to. And they lead me to my last question. Puzzling or not, does that past really matter? From the way China is written about, it would appear that it does. So much so that failing to unravel the puzzles makes us all uneasy. I should not disagree with that, but suggest a different way of looking at puzzles. It may be more important to identify and examine them than to struggle with speculations and half answers. It is normal for puzzles to exist, and none should be cause for alarm. The key point to establish is whether China is locked in a stubborn and recalcitrant past that refuses to adapt to new realities, or whether China has truly gone beyond that. There is enough evidence in my mind to show that China seeks modernity above all. The major lesson of the 20th century is that revolutions opened up new opportunities, but they did not solve anything. It is what can be constructed after the conflicts are over that could make the difference. If new institutions are built to last, the need for strong foundations is obvious. Here, traditions of a rich and many-layered past can provide materials for that construction. If they are used wisely, such a past could minimize unease. It could also make whatever is puzzling no more than a set of challenging questions for the thoughtful. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Professor Wang. That was a wonderful survey of Chinese history that you read. And I think you'll all agree, both gave a suggestion of the dialogue between China and non-China that's been going on historically, but also invited us to think about the dialogue that is going on within China about itself. So that was terrifically thought-provoking for me, and I'm sure for the audience. We have 15 minutes for questions for Professor Wang, discussions. I'll ask you to keep comments short and precise. There's a roving mic which will come your way when you are selected to speak. And we have a beginner up there, Ray. If you'll identify yourself, begin by identifying yourself.
Ray Tekia. I'm a practitioner of Chinese medicine here in Australia. Thank you very much, Professor Wang Gongwu, for your clarifying presentation of the history of contemporary China. It provided some clarity on the puzzles that I have also about China and the West.
Ray,
the
can you keep the mic close to you? Yeah.
My question is the road of China going towards the road to modernity, especially establishment of the modern state that replaced the feudal empire system in 1912, as you have mentioned. You made mention about the notion of Minben, which is being developed in China at the moment. Now, whose idea is this? And does the concept of Minben related at all to the concept of San Min Tu Tui of Sun Yat-sen?
Minben goes back to traditional classics. I think it can be traced back to some of the earliest Confucian thinkers who have used it and used it for the imperial state from time to time in order to remind rulers that what they are about is to care for the people. At least that's the background to the origin of the idea. And recently, of course, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao have revived this term as being something that the present state must pay more attention to. To what extent it was to avoid using Minzhu, I don't know. But certainly, it's an equally respectable term for the Chinese people to talk about Minben. To care for the state is something that, to care for the people is something that states are supposed to do. As to whether it has any link with San Min Zhuyi, I don't think so. Of course, you can say that Sun Yat-sen, when he thought of the San Min Zhuyi, was equally looking for ideas from the past that would fit in with the new ideas that he was bringing to China about democracy, nationalism, and the people's livelihood, using the three concepts, using the word Min, using the people in it. And that word people had come to the fore at the end of the 19th century in a way that had not been so carefully thought of for a long time before that. So you can say there's at the back of it all was the modern impact of the West when people talked about the people being more important. And in a way, the Chinese ruling elites were responding to that. They recognized that people were hearing this voice, that the people mattered, and therefore they could actually try and find their way back into the past to find justification for changing their policies and their attitudes towards the people, and therefore make themselves somewhat more popular. But the background is so different between Sun Yat-sen and the leaders today that I wouldn't directly connect the two right now.
Yes, in the middle there. Okay, identify yourself. Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Professor Wang. My name's Brad Homewood. I'm here simply as an interested person. My question relates to a group of intellectuals within China that we've heard about through the Western media that have expressed support for Tibet, and in particular the Chinese constitution and the guarantee in there that the Tibetan people would have meaningful autonomy. How much do we know about these intellectuals, and who exactly are they?
The ones that I recognize from that list of names are all well-known people with what might be called dissident ideas who have criticized the government for one thing or the other, a whole series of questions they've raised about Chinese policies. So they do have something in common. They do recognize the failures of the present government and insist on raising them whenever they can. On that question of Tibet, and there were many other issues also, but the Tibet one was particularly interesting to all of us, was the fact that they were really wanting to see the Tibetans treated better, but as Chinese, as the people of China. In other words, no different from other people of China. They should be well treated, their rights, like all other Chinese, should be respected, and the government was not doing enough for that. And that's the nature of their criticisms, as it were. There is nothing there to suggest what some people might think, that they are actually for Tibetan independence or anything like that. Nothing like that at all. I think they care for the Tibetans as Chinese, as fellow Chinese, who are all, in one way or the other, not been hard done by a government that didn't do enough.
Thank you for your talk, Professor Wang. My name is Sandy McLeod. I'm a teacher of Chinese in Victoria. You often hear people who are talking about Chinese government and saying that because they're opening up their economy, that their government will inevitably change. Do you think this is a justified... I mean, the Communist Party seems to have survived the market system or the modified market system very well. Do you think that a change in the economy will necessarily mean a change of government, Do you think that's necessarily a good thing? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it will necessarily change the nature of the government, but not necessarily to be anything like the United States. I mean, that's a different question altogether. I mean, the government has been changing remarkably in the last 30 years. I mean, you think of what it was like 30 years ago. And in 30 years, we're looking at a government now that has more confidence in itself, greater stability within itself. It has institutionalized succession, for example. That's something that, as far as I know, no other Communist Party in the world has ever done. But now they've actually institutionalized it in a way which at least assures both the party itself and the people of China who are going to be the next generation of leaders. And that actually gives people some sense of stability. But economic change, I'm not just following Marx, but economic change does, I think, lead to political and intellectual changes. It simply has to, in my view. There's no question about that. But any thought that this is necessarily the road towards the kind of democracy that the West practices, I think that's illusory. I mean, China has its own history, its own past, its own ways of doing things. And the Chinese people, there's so many of them. They're not just a few people. They're all thinking. I mean, let me just say there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of thinking Chinese who trying to work their way out of all the problems they now face. And I doubt that the only thing that would satisfy them is simply to imitate the West.
Okay, we have one right at the back here, then one down here.
Hi there, thanks for a great talk. My name's Jai Allison. I read in the paper a while ago, I think it was The Age, this concept of a bargain between the Chinese government and the Chinese people, or the unrest, the uneasiness that we've spoken about tonight. And the bargain was the economic growth brought about stability, and there was sort of, they mentioned a magic number of 8% growth that was required by the Chinese economy to maintain that stability. And I wondered if you could just talk about that and give your thoughts on it. Thanks.
I don't know enough about economics to know whether 8% is a magical figure. All I know is that the Chinese are concerned to have jobs for all the young people who are growing up. This is truly serious. The last figure I saw was something like 6 million graduates are going to join the workforce in just a few weeks' time when they leave the universities. Now, 6 million graduates in a time like this, when there's already tremendous unemployment in all the industries that are losing out and not exporting as much as they had hoped for, must be producing a great deal of anxiety in high places in Beijing today. 8% may or may not be all that significant, but I think it was kind of used as a rough guide to the whole country. It's an enormous country. And what they did was, in typical sort of Chinese way, which in fact not that different from traditional as well as Mao Zedong's time, is simply to announce a goal and then exhort everybody to follow. And I think that is the Chinese way of doing it. They announced that 8% was right and essentially sent the message to every official down the line, to the smallest townships and villages, that they each have to do their duty and produce and expand by 8%, which of course is nonsensical. It doesn't work. Things don't work like that. But I think as a kind of a rough goal to inspire their officials to work harder, to produce more and so on, was what the, might be called the crude approach that they took. So I think that's what it's used for. But whether in fact, and this is where you need a good economist to tell you that, whether in fact 6%, 7%, 8% or more would be essential to have stability in China, I don't really know. I only believe that if they stop growing at the fast speed that they have been growing at for the last 30 years, they will feel there will be a lot of pain all around. And that pain could translate into a much wider and more dangerous unease and trouble around the country. And the leaders really don't want that. So I would say they would do their utmost to keep whatever magical number they evoke. They would try and keep to that as a means of ensuring that the kind of troubles they already have would not expand to a point when they no longer can be localized and then can somehow cohere into something much larger and wider, nationwide. That would be truly dangerous to the party in power.
Okay, I'll take two more questions, one here and one there. This one first. Down the front here.
Ross Garno, University of Melbourne. Gung Wu, can you help us interpret an intriguing exchange between China and the West in Beijing a couple of weeks ago? The US Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, addressed a full auditorium of students and staff at Peking University about US China relations. In the question time afterwards, a young student asked the Secretary for the Treasury whether the $1 trillion worth of investments that the Chinese government had made in the United States, mostly loans to the United States government, was safe. The Treasury Secretary answered, China's investments in the United States are very safe. And the whole auditorium erupted in uproarious laughter. Was this out of puzzlement or unease? Puzzlement, unease, or something else?
I don't know. I don't normally laugh when I'm puzzled or uneasy. So it must be something else. But why exactly, I can't put my finger on it. I would simply say that the old saying that the Chinese make good businessmen is not all that wrong. I wouldn't say that every Chinese can make money, but that they understand money, that because it's been a long, long, all these centuries they've had knowledge of currency, cash, and trading, negotiation, especially over property. They're very good about that. So I say deep down, the Chinese understand something about exchanges, commercial and economic relationships. And this one made them laugh. But precisely why, I cannot read in their minds, but I think they've done their own sums. And they think that Mr. Geithner is being very clever.
And last question over here.
Derek McDougall, Political Science, University of Melbourne. I was very interested, Professor Wong, in what you're saying about China and world order, particularly the moral basis of such an order. What kind of world order does China want, apart from China having a very respected role within that order?
Traditionally, the Chinese idea of order, of course, is centered on its own safety and security. And for about 3,000 years, they were pretty safe on the whole. They were not really attacked by anybody who had an alternative civilization to their own. They were attacked by a lot of tribal confederations, a lot of groups of people who troubled their borders and every now and then broke through. Most of them didn't stay very long. Some of them remained and became Chinese. So their experience of order has been relatively simple. They've never had the experience of the whole globe being involved in China, or that China should be actually involved in every country around the whole world. It was not until the 19th century that actually they became aware of so much of the world. And it was only in the 20th century that they fully understood how deeply involved and enmeshed in the fate of the world they are. So it's something very new. So the traditional moral authority thing is simply something at the back of their minds. They know it doesn't work. It couldn't work in its original form. But at the back of their minds, they do feel that is the only security they understand. Only if there was such a moral authority and the world was at rest, so to speak, that China could feel really safe. The enemies now are not just around the borders, but can come from everywhere. And as you know, with modern technology and modern weaponry, there's no defense against anything. It can come from anywhere. And I was in China at the time of the first Gulf War, when the first President Bush launched the first Gulf War. I remember being particularly struck by how the Chinese were fascinated by how easily the Americans defeated their enemy. And the use of the superb weaponry that the Americans had absolutely fascinated them. I don't know whether they were frightened or not, but they were really fascinated by it. And this was became the talk for quite a long time. Of course, the second time round, it was even faster. But generally, what they became quite clear after that first Gulf War, that America was all-powerful. There's no question of challenging America or doing anything to disturb America or irritate the Americans. They recognize that that is something that if the Americans are prepared to use it, there is no way China could defend itself against that. But what I think they'd also learned is that there may be other ways of defending China against any possible attack from an enemy like the United. If America became an enemy, what would the Chinese do? What can they do? How can they help to create a world order in which the Americans would not and could not and ever attack China? Because that's the only power that can really threaten China today. No other power has the capacity to conquer or change the regime from outside anyway, that the Chinese see. They may be wrong, but this is what they see today. Now, then the imagination would be, how can we set up an order in which this sole superpower with all this fantastic weaponry could not be used against China? I think that would be quite satisfactory for the Chinese if they could do that. And the world order that they used to have, this idea of Tianxia, of course it doesn't ring any bells today. But I think what they have in mind is that they could in fact have Tianxia. Even Tianxia in those days meant that it could secure in each different way allies around the neighbor, in the neighborhood, and allies beyond the neighborhood who keep the neighbor peaceful and help China make China's neighbors peaceful, ensure that none of them would threaten or attack China. I think it is possible to project that into what the Chinese are thinking today. Can they not create a world in which their friends and allies elsewhere, far and near, could be balanced in some way, some kind of equilibrium whereby none of them, including the United States, would ever contemplate disturbing the peace or creating any kind of dangers for China? Maybe that's the best I think they can do, but this is the kind of thinking I believe it's entirely possible in the Chinese minds, given their history of what it takes to be peaceful again. And after all, if you look at it, they were very peaceful in the neighborhood. There were no dangers to China. And they didn't go very far themselves. They were all their interests were in making sure that their borders would never be threatened. And in fact, that is one reason why we talk of China as being very isolated. I mean, isolated meaning that they were far from the West. You know, anybody who was far from the West was isolated. And nobody was afraid of China. I mean, look at the whole history. No, except the immediate neighbors, of course. Some of them were. But they were just, they had a relationship with China, which actually, on the whole, when you look at the 3,000 or 4,000 years of their relationships, on the whole, pretty peaceful. So I'm not promising anything for the Chinese. I don't know what they're going to do. But I think if they go on thinking along those lines and hope for a world in which there is so much peace and stability all around, that nobody will ever threaten China again, will be something that will be more than satisfactory to their people.
Thanks, Professor Wang. And thank you all for being such a wonderful audience, asking very interesting and very disciplined questions across a whole range of issues that have given us all time to extend our reflections on top of what Professor Wang had spoken about in his address. There are two fest shrifts have been written for Professor Wang. And in one of them, I think, is it Diasporic Ventures, edited by Gregor Benton?
Oh, yes.
You can read a long and very interesting interview with Professor Wang, in which will give you further insight into the thoughts of Wang Gungwu. I know you'll join me all in thanking him again for his time, expertise.
Thank you. Thank you.